like getting married, Nathan.
Careful now.
Exceptionally brilliant for a lot of people, and Mbappe has that quality.
For the best Euro 2020 coverage, subscribe now to the OTB Football Podcast wherever you get your podcasts, and download the OTB Sports app.
The OTB Podcast Network with GetZetGo. Car insurance is boring, but saving money bounces it into brilliance. Enter promo code SPORT and save €40 off your car insurance with GetZetGo.ie.
The Off the Ball Podcast on OTB Sports Radio, Ireland's first and only sports radio station.
Now, very happy to welcome our next guest to the show as we look forward to the Olympics. Liz McColgan will be a name very familiar to athletics fans of the 80s and 90s, Scottish middle distance runner. In 1991 in Tokyo, her finest hour, she won the 10,000 metres world championship. That same year, she was named BBC Sports Personality of the Year ahead of the likes of Will Carling and Gary Lineker. 3 years before that, at the 88 Games in Seoul, she won silver also in the 10,000 metres. And this year, at Tokyo, you'll be watching her daughter Eilish competing at the Games in the same event, the 10,000 metres, at her third Olympic Games. Great to say Liz McColgan joins us now. Liz, great to have you with us. Thanks so much.
Thanks for inviting me on.
So, I mean, it's mad, isn't it? Like mother, like daughter. You reached three Games as well. I think just three Scottish women have made three. Lee McConnell and now the two McColgans. So that's a pretty cool achievement.
Yeah, it's quite a sign of longevity when you get to three, because they're every 4 years, aren't they? So so it's quite special to make, you know, three. And I think even more special that my daughter has sort of equalised what I did as a professional athlete. So there's a lot of similarities running along the whole traits of what Eilish did, you know, as a, you know, she's matured into the distance runner that she is. And it's great that, you know, had the career that I had, but it's even better actually watching her progress and do what she's doing at the moment.
Mm. She's coming after you. So your 1991 national record in the 10,000, 30 minutes 57, and her PB at the moment is 30 minutes 58. So she is hunting you down. I want the honest answer here. You do not want her breaking this record. Come on.
No, I do actually, because I've known all along that Eilish was a better runner than me, and it's took Eilish an awfully long time to believe that herself, because, you know, it's very, very difficult when you're following the path of someone that's been successful, but it's even worse when it's a parent. And, you know, she's had a lot of kind of negative things happen to her throughout her running career, and I've always had the belief that, you know, I've known since she was 12 years old that she's capable of running, and that, you know, from what I've seen as I'm coaching her from the age of 12, is that she has the ability and she's a lot faster than me. Maybe in the early years she wasn't as tough mentally as me, but she's now got that in her, you know, in her chain now too. So, over the years, I've known for a long, long time that she's a lot better than what I was. Wow. I never really achieved the times that I should have. I was a bit slower than what I actually trained. I trained a lot faster than I actually got in the performances that I did. So Eilish, I think, will really just shatter my 10K for one, and she'll definitely get my marathon 2:26, that's for sure.
Why did you train faster than you raced?
I think back in the day, we didn't have the technology that we've got just now. You know, we don't have like super shoes. We don't have lights that are leading us. We didn't have pacers, you know. Back in the day, I was kind of the pacer. You know, I had a bit of a thing in my head that, you know, I didn't see the point in going to races and just letting people sprint past me all the time. So, you know, I really took a lot of the races on myself. And when you do that, you know, it's a lot harder to actually, go and aim for a time per se, rather than just trying to win a race. So they weren't like time trials and that back then, you know, they were proper racing. You had to respect what everybody else in the race was doing, and so a lot of the times, you know, it would be more tactical rather than like eyeballs out and everybody going for a fast time, because it very, very, very rarely happened in my career that I could actually stand on a start line knowing that everybody was going for a, you know, sub 8:30 or a sub 14:50 or a sub 31 minutes. It just didn't happen back then.
Yeah. I do want to talk to you about your career and hear about your career. And there is like this weird, amazing symmetry. Tokyo 91, 10,000 meters world champion. And here we are 30 years later, and your daughter is going to her third Olympic Games again, back in the same city. It's quite extraordinary. So you said there, Liz, you've been coaching her maybe since the age of 12. How does her training, and I know you've talked about the difference in racing there, but how does her training in 2021 differ from your training in 1991? I presume it's moved on a lot, or has it?
Yeah, it's completely different because she's a completely different athlete. Her strengths were are not the same as what my strengths were. Okay. Ailish has got a lot more top end speed. Takes a bit of time to get there, but when she's in gear, she's got a good turnover. Where I was more strength based. You know, I had to be good pace from, like, you know, if you were doing a 10k, I'd be like thinking from 5k out, how am I going to win this sort of thing. You know, so completely different athletes. But at the end of the day, we've came from, you know, I don't train Ailish like the way I did. I did a lot of high miles. Ailish doesn't do, you know, she probably does like a third of the miles, two thirds of the miles that I do. She does a lot more quality in her running. So there's no comparison as to what the training sessions is like. The only good thing that I bring to the table is, obviously, you know, I've been there and did that, and I kind of know the distance really well and what it takes to be successful at it. And obviously, because I've had the opportunity to work with Ailish since she was like 12, right through now she's 30, you know, you gather a lot of information on what that athlete, you know, what makes her tick. Mm. And as a coach, you know, I've been very fortunate. You know, normally you'll lose your athletes, you know, to other coaches and all this sort of stuff as they grow up. And so fortunately for me, I've been able to coach what was a wee girl into a woman. And I kind of know her inside out, and I kind of know what makes her run well now, especially with the distances that we're moving up to.
Yeah.
And obviously my background in running and what I believe the ethos of endurance running is, it fits well with Ailish.
Yeah, Christmas dinner would be a bit awkward if she got rid of you as the coach, I think.
There was actually an instance where she was actually told to get rid of me for funding. So okay. Yeah, we've been through quite a lot of issues with Ailish, trying to keep her, you know, progressing. And there were several people who thought that the partnership wasn't good. And you know, for a small period of time, because of our funding, and for to keep her on funding, we did contemplate, okay, we'll do what they want and let's go and get you another coach. But she just didn't feel comfortable at all with the people that she was talking to, and, you know, it never materialized. And we just thought, well, if you're going to lose your funding, we'll lose it and we'll just keep doing what we're doing.
And that sounds a bit odd. What would be the logic behind, well, we'll fund you if your mother's not your coach? Why would that matter to funding?
Just the people in charge, like, you know, clash personalities probably didn't like me personally as a coach. It happens, even at the highest of the athletics field, it happens. And, you know, it was a situation that arose, and we tried to, you know, we tried to support what was best for Ailish, and certain people that were in charge just thought that I wasn't the best situation for Ailish as a coach, which I thought was a bit out of order. But you know, that was the situation we were in back then. But luckily for Ailish, you know, we kind of kept working together and kept it tight and kept moving forward. And you know, the people that did say that now are in a lot worse positions than us now, so you know.
And you know, so I take your point that she's a different athlete to you and has different strengths, so you trained differently, and I presume that applies to all athletes of all eras. They will all train a bit differently depending on their strengths. But as a general rule, in so much as there can be a general rule, would the athletes of today be doing fewer miles than your generation?
No, I think it's a right mixed bag, isn't it? I mean, right. I think that there's, like, when I was sort of running, it was kind of like the ethos of you had to do lots of miles for to be an endurance runner. And I think it's kind of changed a lot, because there's a lot of athletes out there that, you know, can't sustain, you know, they're not strong enough to do all those miles. And, you know, they're finding now with the sort of new information that comes out about cross training and beneficial, you know, sort of underwater treadmills, and you know, there's an awful lot of other things out there that technically support you better rather than pounding, and a lot of people's body aren't robust enough for that. So you know, I think that as we've sort of moved on, we've had a little bit more technical input and a little bit more science support that kind of helps people that are of that ilk that can't do the types of miles that I used to do. But that doesn't mean to say that they're any less an athlete, because every athlete has got to find their way, and they've got to find their program that supports them to be the best that they could be. Because at the end of the day, that's what it's about. It's about supporting the athlete to run as fast as they can. And just because you run 75 miles and do, you know, 30 hours of cross training doesn't mean to say you're any less a runner than someone that does 120 miles a week. But it also means too that you can't beat that person, you know, because you're still training, you're still getting the hours in. and still working the heart and lungs. You're just doing it in a different way.
So Whitfield Estate, Dundee, you're growing up. Are you from a running family? Is running in the genes, or where does all this come from?
No. My family were probably, my mum and dad were probably the most unhealthiest people you'd ever get. You know, I mean, when I was 12, I was heavier than I am now because of bad diet, you know, fried bread, you know, cheap fried food all the time. Mum and dad smoked about 60 cigarettes a day. Okay. You know, so it wasn't a nice, healthy environment. Nice. I think for me, there's something sporty genetically because, like, my family actually came from Sligo, my dad's side of the family. And we had a lot of boxers. So there's a lot of, sort of like, fitness in the Lynch's side. Of what we were, but when we kind of researched my dad's side in that, you know, everybody was saying, well, there's never been a runner, but there has been a lot of men that were, you know, into boxing and stuff like that. So, you know, I suppose, you know, somewhere down the genetic tree, there's some sort of sporty ability. But within my immediate family, I had one brother that played football, was a pretty decent football player, until he got injured, and he, you know, he kind of sort of stopped playing when he was in his 20s. So nothing that kind of came out that, you know, I'd be good at sport. The only thing that was good about athletics for me was when I was younger, I didn't have a lot of opportunities because of, you know, we were in a council estate, and you didn't get a lot of opportunities to do anything. And I was never engaged at school. So for me, I used to just, you know, love all the sport and things, like, you know, the PE department kind of took me under the wing, and I was more into hockey and football and doing all the things with the sport at school. And when running came along, because it didn't cost anything, for me personally, it was a great engagement for the way my mindset was. You know, I had a lot of bother in my childhood, and for me to go running was a way, like, of escapism. You know, I kind of got into my own little world, and I was able to go out and nobody can bother me and whatever. And I think that, you know, I've kind of trained like a Kenyan without even knowing it, because I just used to go out and run for miles, and, you know, I'd run to school, I'd run to training. So, you know, there's a big base that I did as a child without really understanding, you know, that I was setting this big base for an endurance runner later in life.
Right. I didn't realize any of that. And what was the bother, Liz? How serious was it?
Just a lot of poverty about it. And, like, you were kind of just left to your own devices, and not a lot of direction, a lot of bullying at school. You know, a lot of things that just happened in that environment. You know, I had a lot of, you know, certain things happened, and I had to deal with them. And, you know, it was kind of like, you know, when you're 12 and 13, you're still not old enough to actually deal with a lot of things that get flung at you. And, you know, and it was just very, very difficult growing up. But as I say, I think that, you know, without the running, it would have been a lot worse for me. And I think the running kept me on the straight and narrow. A lot of people that were involved around me were into drugs and alcohol. And I got even bullied more because I wasn't willing to hang out with those sort of people. And so it was really, really difficult for me. Saving grace was when I did get the opportunity to go off to America, and it took me completely out of that environment. And it actually gave me an insight of, you know, what a real runner needs to do. And it gave me the opportunity to train. And that was, you know, that was like a big turning point for me, because if that had never happened, I would never be sitting here in the position I am today, that's for sure.
Wow. We had a guest in studio last year. He is a mountain of a man. He climbs like K2 and Everest and does all these amazing adventure pursuits, and, you know, strong and fit and everything. And he came to studio last year, and he must have talked, he was in for about an hour, and he must have spent 25 minutes talking about the bullying he experienced at school and the effect it had on him. And, you know, couldn't get his breakfast down in the morning thinking that the bully was waiting for him. And there was just, I think, more so in your day probably, and to an extent my day, and hopefully it's gone now, more so from kids these days, and parents and teachers are more on top of it. But the effects of bullying are horrific at that age and lifelong, and, you know, can almost be, oh, well, that was, you know, it was just a bit of bullying, that's just the way life is. But I mean, when you're going through it, it's horrific.
it's really, really difficult to take because, you know, the whole world's just on your shoulders. And my situation was, it was a gang of girls who were getting directed from someone that I thought was a friend of mine, but was obviously really jealous of the fact that I was starting to run well and making, you know, getting my name in the papers and whatever. And what happened with me was, you know, she used to inform them where I would be training, and there'd be a group of about, you know, 10 old girls all going to where I train to beat me up. And so I would then need to go out of my way. And you're talking about, instead of being like a mile and a half up the road, I might need to run 5 miles to get home just to be safe. And then they started doing it at the school, you know, coming to the school gate, writing things on school walls about me. It was really, really horrific. And yeah. As I say, the only thing that really sort of saved me was my coach at the time, Harry Bennett, noticed there was something going on because I just got very quiet and very, you know, I didn't want to go train. I was saying, oh, you know, I don't think I can come tonight and all this sort of stuff. And he was like, he cottoned on something was up, and he called me up and says, like, you know, you need to come down to my house. I need to get a chat with you. And then that was when, I was able to open up and say, look, this has been going on for like a year and a half. It's getting worse. You know, everywhere I go, you know, there's girls threatening to beat me up. And he was the one that says, OK, I'm going to sort it. And, you know, he used to walk me through the park at night, making sure that I got home safe. And he really went out of his way to actually try and, you know, make me feel that I could continue doing what I was doing. And what I was doing, you know, wasn't wrong. It was them that were wrong. Yes. It's them that got the problem. And, you know, yeah, it was really, really tough for a couple of years. But as I say, you know, I was able to sort of ride it out. And then, you know, when I was about sort of 16, 17, it kind of all, you know, girls left schools and you obviously went into other things. And then I wasn't the one that, you know, was going to be the sounding board for them anymore. Like, you know.
Yeah. Oh, that sounds absolutely horrific. I can only imagine what that's like. He sounds like a great man then, Harry Bennett, your coach, if you're so vulnerable that you felt, you know, one, he spotted that something might've been wrong. And then when you confided in him, that he, you know, he did right by you and got you through it, because, you know, those situations can go the other way sometimes.
Yeah, I always think that, you know, one person and one word can make a difference, and it makes people feel safe and things. And for me, Harry was a guy that, you know, Harry coached me since I was like, when I first started running, I got sent along from my local school, St. Saviour's. A PE teacher sent me along, and the very first day, Harry was the first guy that I met, and he coached me from the age of 12. And even though I wasn't the best, I think he saw something in me, and he really took me under my wing. You know, it was him that kind of educated me in running. You know, I'd be doing a training session, he'd be throwing books at me and say, read this and read that. And all the other kids were like, you know, why is he so interested in her? Like, you know, she's not even the best, we're better than her, and things like that. But I think he really saw something, you know. And when I was 16, he was always the one person that could put confidence into me, because I was very, very an unconfident child because of my surroundings and the situation I was in. I wasn't the most confident. Sure. And he was the one that really gave me confidence to believe and to sort of be allowed to dream outside the box, you know. You know, like you would say, oh, you know, you're going to be a great runner and you're going to do, you know, the Commonwealth Games are going to come in and, you know, you're going to run a 10k, and I'd say to him, but women, how far is 10k? And he'd say, oh, it's 25 laps. And I'm like, women can only run 7.5 laps, what are you talking about? And he says, I'm telling you, you're going to do it. And as soon as he said it, I'm like, well, yeah, I'm going to do it. So 25 laps is going to come in at some time, and I'm going to do it. And he was right, because I ran the first 10,000 meters at the 1996 Commonwealth Games and won it. So, you know, he really was ahead of his time, and he was just one of these guys that you know, he just made me feel that I had something special that nobody else did. Mm. And nobody could understand or even foresee. He saw something that nobody else did. And if it wasn't for him, you know, I wouldn't have got the scholarship to the States, because it was him and my uncle that actually paid for the flight, because I couldn't afford a flight. He paid for it with his own money. You know, and he had his own family, and his family were all supportive. His wife, I, and these kids. And it was just one of these really special relationships where I was very, very, very fortunate to meet a guy who was willing to support a kid like myself and really nurture them and let them grow and just see that little spark of something special in them. And I think that there are people out there that do make a difference, and he was one that made a massive difference in my life.
God, that's amazing. Jeez, Liz, I didn't realize you were a million to one shot, really.
Yeah, the only sad thing was, like, even though he predicted, you know, like, I'd go on to do great things. In my first year at university in the States, I came home that summer, and it was the second summer I came home, and he was come to pick me up on his motorbike, and we were going to go away to the Cooper Highland Games because I was going to do an 800 meter handicap race. And I got a phone call in the morning from his wife saying that he had collapsed and died on a run that morning. So when I was just for my 18th birthday, he actually passed, which was something that was really upsetting for me, because I just assumed he would be there for the rest of my days. But he obviously, unfortunately, he wasn't. But obviously his legacy and what he built in me, and even today, my whole ethos is always thanks to him. He's the guy that made me who I am, and gave me the mindset that I've got and the way I think and things like that. He's the guy that really installed all that into me as a runner.
Wow. And your scholarship in the States, Idaho, did you enjoy that? Was that everything you hoped it would be?
It was a bit different. Obviously, I'd left school at 16 with no qualification, and I was working in a jute mill for £23.50 on Maggie's YTS scheme back then. Right.
What's a jute mill? Sorry, jute.
Jute mill is like where you make it's like a, it's weeding, and it's like you make the backs or the sacks of, or say, like, you know, sacks of potatoes. You know the way you used to get those sort of straw sacks?
Yes, okay.
Or like the upper layer of a carpet. It's kind of like that sort of stuff. So it's like loom.
That's jute. Right, okay. Yeah. So you're working in a factory there?
Yeah, I was working in a factory there from, like, it was a long old day. It was something like started at 5:30 and finished like at 5 for £23.50 a week. It was a tough old thing. It wasn't great for me trying to run, because Harry used to come and pick me up, and I used to try and run at lunchtime or try and finish at 5:30, meet him at 6 and go and try and train. It was really difficult. And then when within that year of working, I had ran 207. I was 17, I ran 207 for an 800 metres. So that put me third in Britain for my age group. And so this guy called me, a guy called Mike Woods from America phoned me, and he says, oh, we'd love to offer your scholarship. And I thought it was somebody messing about, and I just put the phone down on him. And for some reason, he got Harry's number. And Harry phoned my mum and dad, and I said, no, I'm not going, because I'd never been outside Scotland or anything. I hadn't had any education. And he said, no, you need to go. He says, because if your running can take you to see the world, what are you going to do here? You're going to do absolutely nothing. He says, so this is the best opportunity for you. So I had to go and sit an SAT test, which I passed. And then I got into the school. I got over in Idaho, which was a junior college, for BYU. And what I didn't know, and what nobody told me, was BYU was a Mormon school. So the first time I came across that kind of religion. And I mean, as I say, I didn't have any finances to get there, so I had no choice. Harry was like, you know, you're going. And he just frog marched me down to the bus station, and him and my dad and my mum put me on a bus, and that was me off. I went to a place I had no idea where it was. Nobody I knew there. I was absolutely devastated. I thought it was the worst decision in my life, and getting made to do it when I didn't want to do it. But went over there, found it really hard to settle in. I got put into an apartment that had four girls, and we were told that we had these five guys as what we called brothers, who had to come and teach us the Mormon, the Book of Mormon. Every Monday we had to do like scriptures and things out of it. And it was just really quite overbearing for someone that's never really known anything about religion. And I wasn't able to drink tea, wasn't able to drink coffee. I got fined for wearing shorts running to the running track. It was really quite hard to settle in. But after about 3 months, I kind of got my feet and I kind of wised up to it. And I was able to sort of like work my way around it. And I think just the old sort of Scots girl kicked in. And I was like, you know, I've got to make the best of what I've got. So, my mum started sending me little secret packages with coffee in it, and Mars bars and Kit Kats and things like that. And, I kind of sort of worked my way around, saying that, you know, I didn't really need to be getting scriptures read to me and whatever. And I'd go away training or whatever. And I got a really good balance in my life. And when I was there for just over a year. And within that year, as soon as I settled in, I started running really, really well. And I won every national junior title that was available, cross-country, track, indoor, won all that. Wow. And then I got highly recruited from the 4-year school, Division II schools. And then I actually met my ex-husband, Peter, who's from Strabane. I met him out in Rexburg, Idaho. And then I got offered a scholarship to Alabama. And so I then went to Alabama. And then Alabama was a massive turning point for me because it was, a bigger school, a lot better support. The team around me was amazing. There were some great runners there. So it was really challenging to train with people. And I won NC2A's indoor mile there as well, got second in the 2 mile. So I had quite a successful time at the University of Alabama. But the greatest thing there was the coach was really, really supportive of me and knew that I was, from Europe and whatever, and that Europe racing was really important to me. So he didn't overly push me while I was on the American sort of circuit. He said he would just be happy with me as long as I ran regionals and as long as I ran finals and ran them well. He was very supportive of the way that I was training and trying to keep, a little bit back so that when I came back to Europe, I could run really, really well. So it worked out well for me. It was a great opportunity and great experience. And it did make me into a world-class athlete for sure.
Wow. Life-changing. That's amazing. Can I jump ahead? Because I reckon we could talk all day here if I'm not careful. So 24 years of age, you make the Olympics at Seoul. You are leading in the final, I think, with 200 meters to go, and Olga Bodarenko of the Soviet Union pips you. So you win a silver at the 1988 Olympic Games. Are you going home thrilled to have a silver medal, or is it a feeling of disappointment? Where were you at 24 in those games, and what could you have done?
I was devastated. I was really disappointed. I was a bit disillusioned because I was kind of like, I trained really hard going into it. I made the mistake of when Harry died, for me, it's a lot to do with trust as well. And I didn't really know anybody well enough to trust them to, sort of getting close to me to be my coach. And a lot, several people tried and whatever, and it didn't really work out and whatever. So I was self-coached up to the Commonwealth Games in 86. And then I went to the European Championships and I met a guy called John Anderson, who was another Scottish guy. And, he sort of sold me a big story, and I thought, I think we could work with this guy. And it kind of worked for we worked together right to 88 anyway. And it was a big change in the training program. I could understand what he thought he was wanting to do with me, but what made me strong was my strength's my strength. I'm never going to be a 56 last lapper. It's just not in me. And I think he tried to change me to be more speed orientated. And in 88, I realized that, the training wasn't the best for me. So I was a bit disappointed in myself that allowed the training to be changed in the way that it was. And then I was also very disillusioned with, because of the drug issue in the sport, and, the Soviets and the Germans and stuff, you sort of got a bit disillusioned on what do you need to do to beat these people that are, taking drugs and things like that. And I kind of came back and went through a little depression thing of it. Right. And I was kind of like, okay, I'm just going to retire because, there's no way I'm going to win against these girls, and I know it. And so I kind of had a little semi-retirement, and I decided back then that I was going to try for a baby, and that never materialised. And then just at the back end of 89 going into 90, I was just sort of sitting with Peter one night, and there was a sports programme came on, and Jill Hunter, who's now Jill Bolts, was on. She was representing England at the Commonwealth Games in New Zealand, and there was a big interview with her saying how she was favourite to win the 10K and da-di-da. And I was sitting there and I said to Peter, I'd win that 10K. And he says, well, why are you sitting there saying that? If you think you can win it, why don't you just go and do it? So I took myself off and had 3 months training, and went over to New Zealand and got second in the 3K, no, so bronze in the 3K and gold in the 10K, and I actually beat Jill on that day. Wasn't in the best shape possible, but you know, I did enough to win it.
Yeah.
The race, luckily for me, kind of fell into my sort of like strengths. And then that was me back into it again. So I kind of stopped feeling sorry for myself and got back into the game, and then sort of like, you know, was quite determined to sort of reverse the rules, as you would say, yeah, for, you know, the next championships. And that's kind of like what I set my plans out to do, really.
Yeah. And Liz, when people think of 88, the first thing I think of is the 100 meter race and all the doping that went on there. And, you know, just really exploded in a huge way. And Bodarenko from the Soviet Union, I don't think she ever tested positive. I was having a look, but obviously the state sponsored doping was an issue then, every bit as much as it has been recently. So you were aware then, was this kind of like an open secret that you had your suspicions, yeah, about certain countries? Like, was it being, because I'm too young to remember, was it being talked about in the media then? Like, would there have been pieces in the newspapers around 88 saying Soviet Union are up to no good? Like, would the BBC TV coverage have been having a conversation saying drugs in the sport? Or was it, how was it treated then? Was it just a secret amongst the athletes?
Just knew from the girls, like from how they performed and what they looked like, and you know, all year round they'd run bad, and then all of a sudden they'd be like, you know, a minute and a half quicker, okay, you know, from the previous race, and you know, there was always communications around tables with the athletes. You know, we knew who were doing it and who weren't. You know, you could just, you know, you kind of knew in the circles that we moved in.
And how prevalent was it? Like when you say you knew it was and it wasn't, like, are you half the field, more?
No, you know, a lot of those rays were definitely at it. And I mean, right, for me, I was lucky enough I got a medal, but you know, there was people like, I used to be in the training, well, I used to room with a girl called Kirsty Wade, and she was a Welsh girl who ran for Team GB in a band. 87, 88, she was running like 157, and she was probably your cleanest athlete back then, and she never got anywhere near a medal.
Okay.
You know, and you know, that's the sort of, you know, we were getting the crotch clovers that were running like, you know, ridiculous. You know, so yeah, it was very, very much a topic that was discussed a nice lot.
Right.
With a lot of the athletes.
Okay. Yeah. So it wasn't like 10, 15 years later, you suddenly realized it was going on. You knew at the time. It's very challenging to be aware at the time. And were you tempted? Were you tempted to go down that route then? You know, like, if they're at it, I'm at it kind of thing.
Never. For me, running is the purest of sports. And for me, the reason that you go into running is about challenging yourself as to, you know, how fast can I go? How hard can I train? And for me, in my mindset, I can't understand anybody standing on a podium knowing that they've cheated, and how in their own head and heart could actually stand there and take a medal. Because for me, it's so far removed from what the sport is. You know, the sport is about it's the purest sport of putting one foot in front of the other and who can do it faster. It's not about what you inject or what your bloods are or whatever, you know. And a lot of people know that they're not good enough to do that, and they're quite willing, you know, to sort of take the shortcut. But, you know, what encapsulated me about my running was the harder the training, the more motivated I was. You know, that's the drive behind it. You know, it's about, you know, how fast can I run? You know, I want to take another 10 seconds off, or I want to, you know, and that's what's encapsulating about, yes, athletics and performance. It's not about sitting back and, you know, putting a needle in your arm or whatever and then thinking, oh yeah, I've did that well, you know. And it's like living with that whole thing yourself. I suppose some people really don't care, and some people think, well, everybody's at it, but that's a defeatist one, because not everybody's at it. There was a lot of athletes that were clean and deserved, you know, better results than what they did back then.
It's such a pity, isn't it? It's just such a stain on the sport, and you wonder, will we ever get on top of it? So, to Liz McColgan's finest hour, Tokyo, 1991, 30 years before her daughter now runs at the Olympics, as we were saying, 10,000 meters, world champion. The insane thing is that your daughter, who was running in Tokyo, this year or in a couple of weeks' time in the 10,000 meters, was born in November 90. Mm-hmm. So that gives you about 8-9 months to go and win a world title, which is extraordinary. I was reading as well, tell me this is not true, that Nike dropped you the moment you told them you were pregnant.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, after 8-8, I kind of tried to get pregnant, and then I thought, okay, I'm going to go back running. Nothing's happening here. And I actually thought that I hadn't had a period for like sort of 8 years or something. So I just thought, oh, I can't get pregnant, you know, that just must be me now. So when I got back into the running, the last thing I ever thought about was getting pregnant again. And when I came back from New Zealand, lo and behold, I did fall pregnant, and I was 4 months pregnant and didn't even realise that I was pregnant. I'd been running like 100 odd miles a week, and my breathing went funny, and I was like, oh, you know, something wrong with my chest and all this sort of stuff. Went to doctors and did a test, and I'm totally shocked that I was pregnant. So, you know, the first thing I did was, you know, I was 4 months pregnant, and the first thing I did was, you know, I need to tell Nike that I'm pregnant, but I have every intention of getting back for the World Championship. Yeah. And the reply was just, well, that's the contract terminated.
Wow. Jeez, that's insane. So, I mean, how the hell did you get back to win a world title in Tokyo from giving birth in November?
Well, I trained through the but I trained smartly, and I wasn't going down to the track with a pair of spikes on and trying to do interval sessions and all this sort of thing. I just kind of kept myself fit and healthy, did a lot of work on my lower back and strengthening hips and pelvises and all that sort of thing. And then as soon as I had the baby, I just got back into it really quickly, and I just kept it really consistent. I didn't do anything that was out there. I just kept it really simple, really consistent, and I think it was the consistency that actually got me to the position in 9 months' time. It took a long time for the body to get back together, because I was actually 12 weeks after I had her, I actually got a bronze medal at the World Cross Country Championships. And it was, although I was got a bronze medal, my body wasn't really back to in shape, you know. I was still carrying a bit of weight and things like that, so it took me a further sort of couple of months to get that into proper shape. And then I would say after about sort of four months, I just started really making big inroads into fitness, and things were falling into place. And I trained really hard, you know. I had a treadmill in like a little sauna room in the house, and you know, I was doing like ridiculous sessions and heat and things like that, making my own sort of like little chamber. But you know, I did push it over the last sort of 4 months, and kept injury free, and that was the secret, really.
Wow, amazing. And so is that must be the pinnacle. Does that mean you can, I know you ran in Barcelona and you ran at Atlanta as well. I think you were fifth in Barcelona, which I guess is a disappointment given your world champion the year before. Does it allow you to retire happy and satisfied, or where are you as you reflect on your career?
No, I think that, you know, your whole career is just up and down. It's like a roller coaster. Yeah. You have like 8 results, and then you have so many much more disappointing results than you do have the glory days. But I think for me, sort of one of the mistakes that I did was after the World Championships, I went right in and accepted an invite to run New York Marathon and won that. And then as soon as I won that, it was like, oh well, you're a marathon runner. And and then that kind of like made me move to the marathon a lot earlier than I probably would have preferred. I would have liked to have just stuck at the 10K for another couple of years, had another Olympics, and then moved up. But that kind of didn't really work out right. And then, you know, I just kind of had up and downs in the marathon as well. You know, I won London, won New York, won Tokyo marathon, finished second twice and third in London, second and third in Tokyo. So a couple of decent podium wins at the international level in marathon. But I just never really, I would have liked to have stayed a little bit longer on the 10K. But, you know, that's when you look back in life and you think, oh, would there be anything that had changed? It probably would have been that.
Right.
But apart from that, it's just been a roller coaster, good and bad, you know. I think I've been very lucky that I didn't really pick up a lot of injuries until the latter end of my career. But when I did get an injury at the latter end, it was a biggie and there was no go back, you know, there was no comeback on it. And, you know, I kind of finished my career a little bit quicker than I thought I would have. But that was kind of out of my hands by then. I picked up an injury that.
Yeah.
That was it.
And when you're not coaching your Olympian daughter now, are you still getting out and running some miles? Is the body okay? Do you still love running?
Oh, I still love running. I mean, I've ran since I was 11, 12 myself. I don't run technically well because I've got a really bad, I've got a rigid foot now because I had 15 operations to my foot.
Oh my God.
And after my win in London, I had had arthritis in my feet and I created an ulcer in my toe bone that rotted the toe bone up. And I was advised to get my toe pinned and 6 weeks later, I'll be back. And then it was like 15 operations later and 2 years later and I had to admit defeat because I had 5 skin grafts as well to my foot. It was just unfortunate that the operations didn't work and then I was left with a lot of issues that just were not compatible with running at high level anymore. So I kind of had to retire then. And when you get that kind of thing flung at you, it's like, you know, the mind's still in the game, but the body's not willing. And it's really, really, really hard to accept because you always think, oh, I'll get back.
Yes, yes.
But it's really, really difficult when you don't get back and you're talking 4 years down the line and you've still been trying to get back and it just doesn't happen for you. So I'm quite happy now that I'm able to go for a shuffle. And it keeps me fit and it keeps my mind healthy.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's really important for me. So I keep myself as active as I can. I went and bought a bike, a month ago. So I've been out on 4 bike rides. So I'm getting a bit into road biking. Okay. I actually quite like that. It actually gives myself and my husband something to do together because John's quite similar. He's had some injuries and can't run every day, so he's a better biker than me though. But it just gives us something to do together. So we've started, you know, we've only been on 4 bike rides, so I could see me getting a little bit more into that as I get older.
Yeah, biking and swimming tend to be where we go as we get that bit older. So with Eilish going to Tokyo and obviously the situation so tricky around the world, will you make it to Tokyo by way of being her coach or anything, or what's the verdict there?
Fortunately, there's no coaches allowed at all. It's only the coaches that are actually on the GB team. And even that, their staff's going to be a lot smaller than what it would normally be for the size of team that they've got. So unfortunately, we're just the same as everybody else. COVID's put stop to a lot of people's travel plans and things. And unfortunately for me, I mean, I missed the first trial, British trial for the Olympics. I missed that last week when Eilish won that. So that was the first, which I was a bit disappointed in. It's not the same watching it on the telly.
No, I wouldn't say so.
But yeah, and you know, so that is as it is. You know, you've got to accept it. That's the world that we live in now, and you just have to abide by, you know, what they're telling us to do. And so no, I won't be going.
Okay. Well, listen, we wish her well. It's great to get your story, Liz. Really amazing kind of come from where you started out to where you ended up, world champion in 91, Olympic silver medalist, pretty extraordinary stuff. So Liz McColgan, best of luck again to you and your family in the Olympics coming up. And thanks so much for this.
Thank you.
The Off the Ball podcast on OTB Sports Radio, Ireland's first and only sports radio station.
The OTB podcast network with Get Set Go. Car insurance is boring, but saving money bounces it into brilliance. Enter promo code SPORT and save €40 off your car insurance with GetSetGo.ie.